Uploading. Tsunami Black Hole Megamix 2K3, now.
The fate of the whole world is in my hands.
You foolish man. I am a Jito Ryo master. Allow me to reunite you with your ancestors.
Right here on the Absolution Network. I'm, of course, your primetime host, Thomas Primetime Metis. And here on episode 31 of the show, we are at our last week of Tsunami Month, celebrating everything Tsunami. And what a better show to celebrate on the last week of Tsunami than what is probably the second anime ever to be on Tsunami after Voltron. That being Robotech, Rick Hunter flying his plane against the Zentradi forces in this Top Gun-esque, well, Macross Plus was more Top Gun-esque, but that's besides the point. But anyways, for such an epic anime, I thought, you know, I really should bring on a friend who knows a whole lot about Robotech, loved Robotech probably just as much as me, though I like more of the Macross version of it, which we will be getting into. Longtime friend, longtime former host, co-host of other shows with me, my good friend Donovan Morgenbrand. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing well, and certainly saved the best for last in this Tsunami week, I think, personally.
Yeah, we had Outlaw Star the first week, Batman the Animated Series the second week, we had Beast Wars Season 1 the third week, and we're finishing off with Robotech, so... I did have one more thing I wanted to do, but I wasn't able to get people to do it. So I'm holding it off until a later date when I can get other people to come on to do it. But I wanted to start like a Tsunami Hall of Fame. And I want to introduce Gundam Wing as the first inductee.
Well, it's best your favorite show.
Well, it's my favorite show, but let's be honest. Is there probably a more well-known show of Tsunami that
Dragon Ball
pretty
Z.
much... Yeah, Dragon Ball Z got fans, but Gundam Wing was really the one that helped launch it in anime. And I know we've had this discussion before. Besides the fact that, you know, who would win in a fight, Max Sterling or Hiro Yui?
Well, yeah, that's a whole other tangent.
Oh, God. Didn't we go on, like, an hour and a half debate on that once?
I don't remember the debate. I remember that was a Fight Club thing on the crawl space, right?
Yeah, it was a fight that...
I think
it was a Fight Club thing on the crawl space, and I think it had to do why I wasn't because of the whole there's this thing folks on a site called the Spider-Man crawl space that both me and Don are part of, and it's a thing called Fight Club where you pick people to fight, and I tried to start this fight with a friend of mine who I knew liked Gundam Wing, And I was trying to have this, you know, he was a fan of heavy arms. I was hoping to try to get this thing to angle it where it would be Wing Zero versus heavy arms. He instead decided to choose the SDF-1 Space Fortress. And I kind of felt that was unfair. And that caused the whole, like, shit storm upon itself, which I think led to us discussing that.
I forgot about it. Was that me or was that Jason? I forgot about it.
That was Jason.
Yeah.
I didn't want to say his name because I didn't want to be disrespectful.
Oh, don't worry. He doesn't listen to this show. It's perfectly fine.
Yeah. Yeah, but still, I want to be, you know, I have more class than that, you know.
Well,
but that's besides the point. But yeah, the Robotech, it's kind of funny. With Robotech, I'm not so much of a fan of, like, the two other parts, which are Southern Cross and
Invenomation.
Yeah,
Massapeeta, right. That's the actual title.
Yeah. I'm more of a fan of Macross and the Macross series itself, which, you know, it's very funny. Macross and Gundam are pretty much like the two flagship mecha series. And it's kind of funny to see, at least in international popularity, how Gundam has taken off and Macross hasn't. But we'll discuss all of that later. But yeah, Robotech I had very fond memories of, but I unfortunately really haven't sat down and watched the Robotech series since, I told Don this the other night, since at least 1999. And with a debate on, you know, maybe a couple episodes in 2004 when Toonami did his little Giant Robot Week thing.
Right.
So, but yeah, I haven't watched, like, episodes straight through since 1999. So, yeah, this was a wake-up call for me.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, the show's, like, almost 30 years old in and of itself. So, I mean, it's surely dated, but then again, there's also a lot of aspects that hold the test of time.
Well, that's very true. And I think it took me a bit of time to get back into it and enjoying it. But, yeah, I there are some story issues. I mean, the story issues aren't as bad as, oh, I don't know, Godzilla versus Mothra Battle for the Earth, which I just reviewed, where, you know, Mothra's destroying the city and you're supposed to have a theme about environmentalism and you keep seeing product placement for Namco.
Awesome.
I'm not kidding. It's just like Mothra's destroying all these buildings and the one building that stands in this, like, whole vicinity, it's a building that has Namco on the side of it.
Well, it reminds me of Disney Code Geass, where there's Pizza Hut, like, in every two episodes.
And we had a conversation. I'll probably have to bring you on if I ever review that series.
Oh, I'd like to talk about that series.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'll probably get into you later about another thing I probably want to bring you on to next month, which...
Well, that sounds like a trap.
Yeah. But, you know, maybe we should get started.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, let's... Again, no emails, no comments. Again, waiting for you people to send those in. But let's go with cast and synopsis first. Cast. The legendary Tony Oliver is Rick Hunter. Rebecca Forsett, though also goes in the name here as Reba West, is Lynn Minmay. And before I should go any further, I probably should have said this before it started, but I'm also going to be saying the actors and then the names the actors used in the credits of this, because a lot of actors didn't use their real names because it wasn't a union job. So technically they couldn't use it as their full names.
I did not know
which
that.
Which I think, yeah. So it's like, there's actually some, like, Robert Axelrod, who plays Lord Zedd, does voices in Robotech, but he doesn't use his name.
No, I think that Tony Oliver, I knew that Tony Oliver and Rebecca Forsett did use pseudonyms, because I didn't know about the whole Reba West.
Well, Rebecca Forsett used an alternative name as Reba West,
right.
But Tony Oliver didn't. Some didn't, and some did, but I probably should have said it before, but I'm going to be saying both names in this case. But back to the cast, Melina McQueen, known in the credits as Aline Lisa, plays Lisa Hayes. Dan Warren, known in the credits as Dan Warner, really a stretch there, plays Roy Folker. Cam Clark, known in the credits as Jimmy Flinders, plays Max Sterling. Richard Epcar, who probably a lot of people know as... why am I blanking on his name now? Botan, I think. I'm blanking on it. The big guy from Ghost in the Shell.
Oh, damn. Hold on. Give me like 3 seconds and I can find that out.
But he voices Ben Dixon. Greg Finley as Guy Garrett plays Henry J. Govel.
Awesome.
The Admiral. Iona Morris as Brittany Harlow plays Claudia Grant. Tony Clay as Jonathan Alexander plays Beatra.
Wait, who? Are you talking about Beatra?
Beatra. It's okay, I have problems with English, Don. You think I'm going to be able to speak Zentradi
like
now?
The head guy with one eye.
Yeah.
Beatra, yeah, that's how I've always known to pronounce his name. That's how I pronounce it in the show.
Yeah. They're Zentradi names. You think I'm going to be able to pronounce? I have problems with English, again. But Ted Lehman, known in the credits as Lenore Pike, plays Eldor, who's Britra's assistant that you see. Gregory Snogoff, as Greg Snow in the credits, which is a much better name as far as I'm concerned, plays Kieron.
Tyron.
And
I'll say it your way, and I'll say it my way.
And Eddie Mirman, known in the credits as Penny Sweet, plays Nira Parina Sterling.
Okay.
And did you find out the name of the...
Is Bato?
Bato. See, I was close. I actually said Bato, and I'm like, wait, that doesn't sound right. I'm like, it was right. So yeah, Bato from Ghost in the Shell. I had it right the first time. I'm actually surprised to see that name, because I didn't think he worked this far.
Yeah,
or that he's like been in the business.
This is sort of like one of the really early anime shows that kind of like... sort of began in the infant stages of anime being popular in the early 90s. It's really
It came out late 80s.
Yeah, it came out in 85 in America, but like it was like one of the was one of those things that kind of eventually birthed shows like, I mean, movies like Ghost in the Shell and Kira that kind of like had that whole fandom start in the 90s. I mean, I know it was in the 80s, but like it was sort of one of these things that birthed it.
I would say that it started in the 80s and it had initial fans, and then it had a resurgence because of Toonami in the late 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But on to synopsis. It's the year 1999, or is it the year 2009? No,
it's 1999.
I got it right. But 10 years before, or am I getting that wrong?
No, it's 19... What? Want me to do this?
You know what? You want to do synopsis? You go ahead.
Okay. Off the top.
Because obviously I can't remember my own synopsis.
Well,
I'm getting my dates wrong.
With in the year 1999, a gigantic alien spacecraft crashed onto the island of Macross, and you know, obviously the military. And apparently this all takes place after a certain global civil war. But that's all in the background. And the people of Macross and obviously the world react to this. And 10 years later, which is where the series starts, by this point they've come to live on it. They've come to, you know, actually adapt it to have build a city inside of it. And in the year 2009, they celebrate the anniversary by having a big celebration, having a lot of flyers and showing that, and showing all of what they've made into. And on that day, the creators of the spacecraft have come to basically take it back. And it's there where we are first introduced to the Robotech Defense Forces, which are essentially military fighter airplanes that actually transform into giant fighting robots, which can combat the alien forces, who happen to be gigantic, like
battleoids.
Yeah, battleoids. I'm trying to think of like they're about like, I don't know, 30 feet tall or whatever in alien weaponry, and that's
the actual name that they use is battleoids.
Right.
And they actually have three modes: plane mode, guardian mode, which is a cross between plane and their battleoid mode, and battleoid.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that's where the Robotech fighters are called Veritechs, where they have the fighter plane modes, and then they can hit a switch, they can go into like basically a plane with arms and legs and a gun. And then the final mode, which is battleoid mode, that mode is called guardian mode or Gerwalk. And the final mode is battle mode, where they're eventually giant fighting robots.
Yeah. And, of course, here is where we meet some of our first heroes, including Rick Hunter, a ace superstar pilot who comes to visit his friend who works for the military, Roy Folker. But when the Zentradi, the enemy who come to try to take back the ship, and just to slowly correct you on something, they didn't create it, but they were hunting down the people who did create it.
Yeah, essentially, because there's confusion over what the spacecraft, which is called the SDF-1. SDF stands for Superdimensional Fortress. There's a lot of confusion about, you know, what is it made for, and a lot of the beginning of the plot is about, you know, the Zentradi trying to reclaim the fortress.
Yeah. And so, you know, Rick Hunter comes, you know, to meet his friend Roy Folker when these aliens attack. Rick gets pulled into the battle, and after Admiral Goya
Global.
Decides to pull... okay, say it.
Admiral Global.
Global. I just have to think global. ladies and gentlemen, I am horrible with names. You should be used to this by now.
He's Russian, sir, yeah.
Yeah. Like I said, I have problems speaking English. But when Global tries to pull a space fold, he ends up taking pretty much all of Macross Island into this jump with him to what turns out to be somewhere in the orbit of Pluto. So from there, we continue on with our adventure of the SDF-1 as they take on the 70,000 survivors of the island from the shelters and try to make their way back through the Zentradi to Earth. And that is our basic story for Robotech, the first 25 episodes, a.k.a. Season 1, as I'm putting it. So with that, let's get into our review of Robotech. With our review, of course, as you usually know, we start up with music, animation, we then have our little break, and then we talk about acting and story. So let's start off with music, and let's first talk about the Robotech opening and closing theme, and in this case, it's Iconicy, which I'm very anxious to talk about since, I'm sorry, I have to say this, Don, and I'm not trying to make fun of you, but Don actually has something to say about the music.
No, it's fine, because I actually do.
inside joke for those who know us long time, Don usually never has anything to say about the music.
Well, only if it personally strikes out to me. I never, you know, when I first saw this show, I was a little kid, and obviously it was in the 90s, and now we're in, like, you know, the 2010s, so it's been going on like at least 10 years since it's really been on the air, but the music's always stayed with me because I find it really exciting. I find it like a very appropriate to the scenes in that, you know, when you see the Zentradi plot their schemes and stuff, there's very alien dissonant type of music. I find that whenever there's a space battle, depending on which way the battle is swinging, it can be from very heroic and adventurous to very action oriented. I find the romance themes to be very, very well done. There's a lot of piano in the background. And I find, I can, as I'm saying this, the themes are kind of rolling off my head. And I don't actually have the soundtrack, but I've always remembered it. And it's just like, I mean, again, since Robotech is sort of a dubbed version of the original version, it's still really, really good. And I think that it's really worth checking out just for that alone.
Yeah. It is really good. I mean, I think the only music I had a problem with is them having Reba West sing for Mid-May. I'm like, and I understand why they couldn't, but they kind of wish they would have actually gotten a better singer for her voice.
I think she's okay. I know she's not.
And she's okay, but it's like, it sounds awkward, especially when she's singing that debut song.
Well, I mean,
smashing. See, I can't even sing the song because every time I think about trying to sing it, I start going into that tune of, what was I just singing now?
Oh, I forgot the name of it. On a stage, right? Go away. This is my big day. I'm embarrassed. I know the lyrics, but I've never forgotten those either.
But that debut song has like similar tunes to that, or at least I am. But but staying on track with the music, the opening theme and the closing theme, which is the Robotech theme, which is that's sort of that's actually the theme that they have start off the Robotech video game that was on the PS2.
Yeah, I was gonna bring that up because I was wondering, because they released, I'll say recently, they kind of several years ago released the game on PS2 that was very much I don't want to say fan service, but it was very much like a fan gift towards people, fans, of the original series. It continued.
Okay.
It sort of told an untold story. It had pretty much all, not I say all of them, but a lot of the main themes and even the original voice actors.
Yeah, I still have that game.
I do too.
But yeah, and there's that. But again, of course, the class theme. Means, da, 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 da. Now I'm trying to remember, and now I can remember is that.
Might be more
thing.
Prudent to actually play it while you're humming this.
Yeah.
Post-editing.
Yeah, well, I already played it, the intro into the review, so, but people know what I'm talking about from that. But yeah, it really is a iconic theme. It's probably one of the best, not only well-known anime themes, but American animation themes. And, actually for it to be a well-known anime theme, that's pretty interesting, again. And I'm talking about anime theme even in Japan, considering that this is an American animation that's an amalgamation of Japanese anime.
Is the Robotech theme, dub theme, popular in Japan? I didn't know that.
I know it's known there. I've seen videos where I've heard the Robotech theme being played in Japan.
Really? Interesting.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing, and I think especially Japanese, and this goes into the whole Macross aspect, but when ADV did dub, they actually they put in a Japanese dub for when they re-released the Robotech series complete version. This is back, I want to say 2003, 2004, they released a complete collection, of Robotech, and they actually added a Japanese track to it. Which I don't think was there before in previous releases.
No, it's okay. So, are you saying that like it was the original version, or was it like a Japanese dub of the Robotech script?
It was a Japanese dub of the Robotech series.
Really?
Yes, and so and I would awesome. Have to imagine that they sold it over in Japan as well over here. So, and they actually got the original voice of Mid-May from the Macross series to come back and do her voice for Mid-May.
That is bloody cool.
So, yeah, I know that it's been over there. And, Macross does have – over in Japan, unlike over here, and again, we're getting to things that are – we'll talk about later. But Macross is just as big as Gundam as opposed over here where Gundam is much bigger than Macross. But, it really is an iconic theme both – in the form of Japanese anime, this being technically an American anime, which I'm sure we're going to get into, and being just plain simply an American animation. It's right up there with the Batman the Animated Series theme, the Thundercats theme, the Animaniacs theme. You're talking about iconic themes of American animation.
Yeah, definitely. Especially in terms of, like, historically, where, you know, it's like, I mean, fans of Dragon Ball Z probably know Rock the Dragon theme in America more than they might know Chala Hejala. But also it kind of depends on, like, you know, what's more mainstream and what's more personal to the fan.
Yeah. And, you know, and going into the tune itself, it really is a great sort of military theme. It's sort of this military victory theme, which I really love them using it both as the opening and closing. In that case, I love the chords that they use for the theme. I love in particular the instruments, the use of a lot of brass to give it this just grand feel to the theme.
It feels very like military-esque. Like whenever you see the military, you always see, like, you know, like almost like a marching band playing, like the theme, like burr, burr, burr. There's lots of trumpets and trombones and all that.
Yeah, that's why I said military theme, you know, the military victory theme, as my tongue trips over my mouth, which is going to be doing a lot. but with that, let's move on to the overall score, and there's a lot of good scores. There's a lot of good battle music, you know, Rick Hunter's theme. Which you probably heard playing behind Donovan when I introduced him.
That thing plays when I'm around people all the time.
But I mean, that theme I liked, and again, you mentioned earlier the Zentradi theme, just this very sort of sinister theme that the Zentradi had. A lot of great soft tunes. Actually, one of my favorites, and I was talking to this with Don earlier before we started recording. There's a tune that plays in episode 19 when
so-and-so dies.
Rick, we'll spoil it later then, but when so-and-so dies and Rick Hunter is contemplating his death, which, by the way, that's the word I was trying to think of earlier. there's this song that plays, and it's very much like Goose's funeral song from Top Gun.
So I just spoiled Top Gun for people who've not seen it.
Guess what? Darth Vader's Luke's father.
As long as you don't spoil Final Fantasy VII, I think people will be okay. Although you probably have.
Here,
you did that.
Here's a spoiler for Final Fantasy VII. Tifa's got big tits.
Yeah, that's certainly what you take away from that game.
Out of everything else, and it goes right back to it.
Out of everything else, that's one major.
Moving on. But yeah, Goose's funeral. It sounds so similar, but it is a very good thing. I mean, I'm tempted to make a joke here, but it really is a good theme. It just reminded me of another theme.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a lot. I can't think of it specifically as much as the other themes right now, but I know my mind kind of like had a memory of it where I can kind of imagine, I see Rick sitting down and looking out the window and like the theme kind of playing over it and like his memories and stuff. So it's very, I mean, it sounds kind of obvious us describing how the music resonates towards the scenes, but it's very successful in what it's attempting to do.
Yeah. I mean, it's not doing anything that's evolving the industry, but you don't necessarily need that with this show. It does what it needs to do, which, again, it does what it needs to do. Mm-hmm. And I love the subtle nods to the original Macross series, though, as well, being that music has much more of a huge importance in the original Macross series due to the fact that Minmay's song is used as an equalizer in battle, because for those who know Macross and know the whole Macross storyline itself, the Zentradi are entranced by song, so the Earth forces use that to get an advantage in battle. So they'll play like Minmay's song to subdue the Zentradi warriors so that they can fight with them on level ground.
Yeah, which I find... part of me... when I was a younger... Robotech was, like, one of my first anime outside of, you know, Voltron and Ronin Warriors. But, like, there's a part of me that, like you know, just takes that as red. And a part of me that's like, that is so Japanese, where it's, like, the soul of, like, one singer can soothe, you know, can quell a battle. It's very Perfect Blue in a way.
Well, you know, but, you know, the thing about that is that really sort of a historical importance going back to World War II, where they had that. both in America and Japan, where they had singers who would, you know, sing to, you know, raise the morale of the troops.
Right. Oh, yeah. It's definitely going on that idea. But like the fact that this is an intergalactic battle with people who've never known the concept of singing before is actually makes it. I'm not saying it's stupid, because I don't think it is, but I think it's a lot funnier.
It is funny. I mean, there's scenes in here where they're talking about Protoculture and, you know, the Zentradi are like looking at the Earth's things that they take back in one of the later episodes of this season. Of course, when the I can't stop laughing at that scene when Lisa and Rick and Ben and are all captured and they're like, "We want to see you kiss." And it's like, okay, I don't remember it getting this hot in here like 10 years ago.
Oh yeah, that's a definite turning point in the series. Like, I think if memory serves, like I think. Doesn't Ben and Rick like who us? No, not in a million years. And he says, no, you and the female.
Yeah. Well, we'll get to that because we'll be talking about those scenes later when we get to story. With that, let's move on to animation. Let's talk about the overall style of Robotech and how the animation has aged. And even though this came out in 1985, we have to remember that this actually, the animation came out in 1982 since it's based off the Macross series.
Right. Super Dimensional Fortress Macross.
Yes.
Which is a long name.
Which the SDF-1, that's the actual name of the ship, is
right.
Macross.
Mm-hmm.
So what did you think of the overall style of the animation?
It's very much of its time because it has its own design. The design of the characters was done by Haruhiko Mikimoto. Because I actually have his art book right next to me. I got it for $100 on eBay. And he's designed a lot of other mecha shows. I don't know if it was before or after Macross, but at the time in the 80s, there's a lot of like, I don't want to say there's like the same kind of designs, but there is a lot of elements that you can see. Now there's like Fist of the North Star and Voltron. There's sort of the same kind of like approach to it, but at the same time, it definitely has its own, as Mikimoto's certain style. Like, if you notice, a lot of characters, even if they're female, have sideburns.
Yeah, and in fact, if you want, I can give you his whole anime work here. He worked on Gunbusters, mm-hmm. Aquarian, Age of the Movie, Tetsuan Autumn from 1980, Blue Remains, Gandar, King of the Burning Desert, Gundam Neo Experiment 0087, Green Divers, High Speed JC, Macross 7, Macross Dynamite 7, Megazone 23, which was this very sort of Robotech-esque show. Actually, it was more of the third thing that's used for Robotech. I'm blanking on the name.
Masapita?
Yeah, with motorcycles for robots. Yeah, they have motorcycles that turn into robots in Megazone 23. He worked on Mobile Suit Gundam 0080 War in the Pocket.
Awesome. you know what? I
Racer.
Didn't know that.
Racer, Salamander, and of course Super Dimensional Fortress Macross, and Macross Do You Remember Love, Macross Flashback 2012, and Macross 2 Lovers Again, Super Dimensional Century Orgris, and Orgris 2, and Titania, which I believe that's a recent, Titania just actually had an animated series that premiered in 2008.
Okay, interesting.
Which is interesting for a manga that like was from the early 80s.
Right. I mean, a lot of his stuff is very... I'm not sure how much, besides War in the Pocket, he did that's modern, but a lot of his stuff is very, like, pretty much like old-school anime, kind of that. And some of that is the animation studios, but you can see the designs are of that period.
Well, and the reason I brought that up is because when I first look at his designs, I'm very much reminded of sort of that second generation of anime, but especially... things like Captain Harlock and Space Battleship Yamato,
yes.
And those type of character designs, and Galaxy Express 999.
I know for a fact there's one like movie, I forgot the name of it, but I saw like a commercial of it, and they have a character who looks like it's not even like a different design. It's basically a color modded Captain Global. It looks exactly the same. So he definitely, I know he has his style, but I think he's, I don't want to say known for repeating his stuff, but like he's definitely known for using a lot of the same motifs.
I definitely think that maybe he got his early teaching from the same studio, and I'm blanking on the name of the animator, who did Captain Harlock and Space Battleship Yamato, because that's all actually the same shared universe as well.
Wait. Shared universe how?
Captain Harlock, Space Battleship Yamato, and Galaxy Express 999 all happen in the same universe.
Oh, okay, cool.
You didn't know that?
I don't think I did.
but again, yeah, it definitely is an old school. And you know what? I definitely have a nostalgic feel for that. If there's anything that I can say wrong about the style, it's some of the cuts. And the hard part about that is that the actual animation or is that Harmony Gold the way they edited it?
Some episodes look better than others, certainly.
Yeah, and so there were, like, the way they cut the animation at certain points in certain things, you know. But unfortunately, that's more of an editor type of thing. And, you know, do you blame the animation or do you blame Harmony Gold? But outside of that, I've really enjoyed the animation. Again, that whole nostalgic feel of that second generation of anime, which ran from, I want to say, 1965 all the way up to pretty much 1990.
That sounds about. It's sort of like going from Astro Boy to.
Well, Astro Boy was actually first generation. I'm talking about like after Speed Racer.
Yeah, I was about to say. What's the original Speed Racer name? Go Mach 1.
Yeah, Go Mach 1. But you know, the first generation ended with Speed Racer, which you know had things like Kimba the White Lions. Astro Boy, Gigantor, all that stuff that really looked a whole lot like the Fleischer Superman cartoons and was really inspired by early American animation. And then you had the second generation where, you know, and I've talked to you about this before, that when you really look at it, it's really heavily influenced by, you know, the godfather of modern anime, Walt Disney's Sleeping Beauty.
That was just back to Disney.
Well, you know, we've actually had this discussion before, and you found that interesting, the way I at least put it to you.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's definitely a gap, and like I've said before, that's the only thing that could have influenced Japanese animators in that time frame to put the type of styling that they put into their animation. Not that they weren't also influenced by the first generation, but, you know, the amount of detail that we see comes directly from Sleeping Beauty. But we're not here to talk about it. Let's get back over
to
it.
No, we're not here to talk about it.
But let's move on to character designs. And I basically split it up into two parts. First, let's talk about the Earth forces. So most of our main antagonists, let's talk about them.
The human characters.
We're talking about human characters. We're talking about character designs specifically. So don't worry, we'll get to Max because I love my mechs.
what I like about it is that they're kind of down to earth for most. I mean, obviously this is before a lot of anime and looking like Code Geass. You know, there's no clamping designs here or anything. But I'm not trying to like degrade that, but I'm saying it's very much where the designs are a little more down to earth, but they still have a very eccentric flair to them. You know,
yeah.
Like a lot of people's hair, I wouldn't say it's unrealistic, but it's still a little more, I don't say abnormal, but it's a little more exaggerated. Like you have like, yeah, Roy Fokker, who has kind of big hair and big bushy sideburns. But, you know, you can see somebody actually walking around in that. Yeah.
I could see sort of a star ace wearing that haircut.
Yeah. And it fits his personality. You have, you have a lot of people who have, you can kind of tell their different styles. You can have, yeah, there's, yeah, a lot of there's a lot of personality in the designs.
In the hairstyles and that stuff. And again, I just love the different characters. You know, Rick Hunter looks, you know, he really does look like an ace, like a superstar ace, along with Roy Fulker. Max Sterling is just such a unique design and interesting design.
Yeah.
With the glasses and
the blue hair.
It was green. Blue hair? That's right, it was blue. I don't know why I was remembering it as green. I'll probably remember Mira.
Spoilers. But if you look at like somebody like Lisa, or Misa, depending on the version. But like, if you look at her, she's a very much, she's probably the most realistic character in the thing, because she looks very drab. She's very, like, I don't want to say plain Jane, but she's very much like, she's very just
very subdued.
That's,
I think,
all. Is... Like, what you see is what you get from her. And if you contrast it to Minmay. Minmay doesn't really address extravagantly until later on in the series, like in the middle part. But like, if you look at their faces, they're both, you know, like Minmay's a lot more bubbly and a lot more.
I was just about to say that. I was about to say, you know, Lisa is much more of a subdued, much more mature character design, where Minmay is bubbly. It's much more of an explosive type of character design that matches her personality.
Absolutely. And I think that, like, that goes over to the men as well, because you have, like, contrasting from Rick to Roy to somebody like Ben Dixon. It's like, you know, like, Rick is a mature person, but also is a little bit, not only naive, but a little bit less worldly than other characters might be, whereas Roy is a lot more cocksure and confident. And you have somebody like Ben who is cocksure and confident as well, but in a misappropriated way.
And by the way, I love the fact that we have a big guy.
Oh, yeah. No.
I love the fact that they're not all, like, the same size, you know. Max seems a little bit skinny, and you know, Ben is just, like, big, sort of burly guy, which I like.
Yeah, and, like, I mean, he has, like, the kind of beady eyes, and then it's contrasted to Max's almost goggle-like glasses, which hides a very skilled, you know, fighter pilot. I mean, he looks so unassuming, but yet he's, like one of the most awesomest fighter pilots in the entire series. It's really fun.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you have to give it up to his fighting pilot skill got him a woman.
Oh, yes. Well, I mean, yeah, his fighting skill and his video gaming skills as well.
Video gaming skills. Yeah, and with that, let's move on to the Zentradi. And the thing I love about the Zentradi is, evil as they were, they also had this down-to-earth aspect to where you could, when there were certain scenes to where they were sort of showing their humanity, you could completely believe into it and feel for them. They weren't just this ultra evil force, and it really was sort of this sort of mirror effect of the character designs of the Earth forces.
Yeah, well, I mean, like, well, first of all, there is like the plot thread that, like, what connects Zentradi to humans, because they are humanoid. They resemble humans. They might be different skins, like purple and greens, but they're still recognizably, you know, they have two arms, two legs, a face. What I like about that is, like for example, Britai, the guy with the cybernetic eye, he has very, like, kind of like a, I don't want to say curly, but kind of like a bushy kind of like hair with these long sideburns. So, like, there are certain styles over there, which is cool. And then, like, you look at a guy like Chiron. He looks like he's out of the 70s with his haircut, like kind of this floppy headed.
You know what Chiron reminds me of? Hmm? What's his name? The prince from Voltron.
Oh, I know. I forgot the guy's name. But I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, but it's like that sort of very. And his voice actually sounded similar to that as well. It wasn't the exact voice, but it sounded similar. It had this sort of same tonal aspect to it, which I really found funny and really liked.
Well, he talks like that, and he talks like sort of a princess-like character anyway. He's a very almost Vegeta-esque in his sort of, like, you know, presumptuous, like, you know, like, I'm the best, and, you know, like, everybody, you know, even if he's not an actual ruler, he's like, you know, I'm better than everybody kind of thing.
I mean, you have to really be a badass to make your own, you know, allies, you know, hate you.
Well, I mean, like, yeah, well, he's known as Chiron the Backstabber, and...
Yeah. But, you know, I love that sort of down-to-earth, and it really helped towards that aspect later in the season when the Zentradi, or a number of them, start defecting.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. It was like, you have, like, I'm trying to think of their names. Rico, Braun, and Conda, I think, which are, like, the three aliens that kind of, like, eventually get used to Earth. And they look...
No, they're the first ones to spy.
Well, they're spying, but, like, what's interesting is that, like, while they're... I mean, they eventually get more acclimated. They look more human than most of the Zentradis do. You know, I mean, their skin tone isn't radically different, and they can kind of pull it off. It's just more of their mannerisms, which is interesting because, like, it kind of shows the diversity in the Zentradi designs, because you can have people that are purple skin, but you also have people that have, like, you know, Caucasian-like skin.
Yeah, and then we have Mira, which I can't do a wolf whistle, but I wish I could. There you go. Damn, Max is lucky. Now I know why you like his character so much and why you're sort of, I guess, jealous of my Max Sterling Robotech figure I have behind me.
I never said any of that. Although, when I was in Comic-Con this past, a couple weeks ago, I was so close to getting a Max Veritech, which could transform and had all this articulation. It was like $30 at the con, and it looked so awesome, and I wanted it so bad.
$30? That's cheap, actually, for figures.
It is. And like the only reason I didn't get it is because by the time I could, I'd already spent enough money to where I couldn't justify getting it. But like, I was mad at myself because it was right there for the taking. It was a Skull One, it was a Max One, and it was like a VF1J or something like that, and like. The Max one looks so cool because it's specifically colored for his aesthetics, and it's just like, I mean, when you're playing the game, Robotech Battlecry, tell me you don't play as that personalized Veritech. I mean,
I actually like Rig Hunter's color scheme more, to be honest with you. I love the red and white for whatever reason.
Well, they're all different like designs which kind of denote certain characters. I mean, I know.
Yeah.
They're all pretty much favorites. I mean, I think the personally the most distinctive is the Skull One because it actually does have skulls on it. It's not just a color mod; it's an actual kind of design, which is awesome, and it's also very powerful. But I mean, I forgot what we were talking about, but like,
we were talking about these Rico and the Zentradi that defected,
right? And also with Miria, I mean, she also has skin tone that's not. In fact, another thing about the only people who look kind of freaky are, I think, Bree Tai and Chiron and Exodor, maybe.
Yeah. And the Supreme Leader.
I forgot her name right now. But, like, because, I mean, Mira has green hair, but she has green hair, but, like, I mean, Max has blue hair. It's nothing more than a
They perfectly sense each other with the color scheme, actually, when you think about it.
Yeah, they really do.
But, you know, that's it for the character designs. Let's move on to mech designs. And we're going to start off with the SDF-1 Macross.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I like it. I like it. It's interesting because, like, it kind of looks like a ship, but it doesn't. It looks more like a big rectangle, you know? It looks more like a boat. I want to say a boat, like a battleship, rather than like a.
It looks like an aircraft carrier. That's what it looks like.
Yeah, like that, which.
Which is actually funny because they end up putting aircraft characters on it for arms after they get space-fold in towards Pluto.
Well, this is that part of like the whole like I forgot what it's called the transformative sort of thing they do where it gets into battle mode, and
it
does have like it does use the aircraft runways as sort of arms like a thing and just punch right through giant ships and stuff.
Well, they're not initially part of the spaceship, but you know when they do the space fold and everything gets caught up into space, they eventually attach the. Aircraft carriers to the ship and then use them as arms, or they get revealed that they're basically become arms in the transformation mode.
Right, yeah, there we go, the transformation mode. I mean, I like it. It's funky because that, for all the similarities between the Zentradi and the humans, that actually looks very alien, and I like how it's utilized because it does have all these freaking guns. I mean, I remember there's a specific image of the SAF-1 that shows the humongous amount of detail that's in that ship and all the things that it has, and it's really, really cool.
Yeah, I mean, I really love that sort of early aspect of spaceships in anime, you know, this space battleship Yamato, to where it is this thing to where these spaceships are really designed to look like actual ships. And sort of that aspect of, you know, so many years ago, a sea was an uncharted exploration and domain, and now space is that next domain and the similarities between that. But and especially with military aspect and military application, it makes sense that this strange technology that they find, they would sort of build it and mold it around technology that they could compare it to.
Yeah.
And be familiar with, in this case, an aircraft carrier.
Yeah. It doesn't have a distinct shape, but it's kind of utilized to form a distinct shape, which is interesting.
Yeah, I mean... I like Space Battleship Yamato, but it's not like the Space Battleship Yamato, which to an extent kind of seems like a combination of a rocket and a battleship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, here, you know, it's vastly different. That it looks like a spaceship, but it has those notes and tones and integral feelings of an aircraft carrier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
And in its robot mode, it's just really freaking awesome.
It is.
With that, let's move on to what is known as the Veritech Fighters, but I rather call it by its Macross name of the VF-1S Valkyrie.
I might want to describe that.
Well, that's what the name of the fighter is in Macross.
Well, I mean they're all different. They have all different code names.
The first the planes that they used, the very first Robotech fighters
are the orange
in the
ones?
Mac. No, all of them.
Well, I mean, like you have like VFs, VJs. You have, they are sort of like a different designation code.
I mean, there's different, like, there's armored ones and that stuff, but all of them basically come from the VF-1S Valkyrie.
Well, in any case, I mean, the basic designs of the Veritech fighters, anyway, I kind of share the same plane transformative gears. I mean, you'll have differentiations. Like, it seems like the more rookie-ish kind of Veritechs have only one, like fireball antenna, whereas, like, later on you'll see... Like, the better ranking you are, you have more. Like, you have two or even four if you're a Skull 1. So,
yeah, and it's kinda nice. And they can shoot bullets, too, which I find is awesome.
Yeah, that's cool. I when he fights Britai, he tries that when Britai puts him against the wall.
Yeah. And by the way, the Veritech fighters were primarily designed by Studio News, Shoji Karimori, and Kazuta Miyatake.
Which makes sense, because I can't expect a guy who primarily designs... Well, then again, I mean, if Mikimoto did do a lot of mecha shows, I mean, through his art book, he doesn't have a lot of military and mecha designs. His designs are mostly towards the human characters, yeah. Which is interesting, because he would figure out how to do that, but it makes sense that there's a different designer for it.
And just because it is a mech thing, and we have the names here, let's go into, because, like, with Shoji, his videography as far as his mech design work... Super Dimension Fortress Macross, the entire series, this includes Zero and Frontier, as long as also being creator. Space Battleship Yamato, he was a spaceship mechanical design. Future GPX Cyber Formula, Vision of Exoflone, Spring and Chaos, Earth Mage and Ardero Family Defense Alliance, which is an awesome name. he worked on Pat Labor. Aquarion, Eureka 7, Mobile Suit Gundam 0083, Stardust Memories, Ghost in the Shell, Outlaw Star. Actually, in fact, he designed the XGP-15A2.
Okay.
And he worked on Armor Core.
Not heard of Armor Core.
He actually also worked on Transformers Generation 1, and actually was one of the first people to design Optimus Prime.
Interesting.
And then with Kazuta, his design, you know, again, Space Battleship Yamato, Super Fortress, Dirty Pair Flash, Mobile Suit Gundam Sea Destiny, Flag, along with Macross Frontier and Gunbuster. So, yeah, these are, looking at what they worked on, yeah, these are, like, some of the best mech designers.
Well, that's another show that, like, is of kind of associated. I mean, at least I associate with the era, not specifically Dirty Pair Flash, but the original Dirty Pair.
Yeah, but getting back on topic, but I just had to go down that road because I want to give credit to these. They don't get much credit in people's reviews, by the way. But I love the Veritech, but I love the transformation aspect. I love the different battleoids, and yeah, I love the different variations depending on what rank you are. I find that interesting. I love the sort of, the transforming aspect and the Guardian mode. It's such a unique and interesting idea for a ship, or for, in this case, a fighter.
Mm-hmm.
But I love sort of the film. Familiarity of the fighter with actual jets. In this case, you definitely sense a comparison to the F-14 Tomcat.
Kind of, yeah. I mean, I'm not really big up on my military knowledge.
Well, I am too. I actually, when I did my whole top 25 mechs or top 20 mech designs, and I was looking at Robotech fighter jet designs, I actually looked at what the different fighters were based off of. I know the VF-1S was based off the F-14 Tomcat. The fighters, like in Macross Plus, like the main protagonist, this fighter, is actually based off the F-22 Raptor.
Okay. So, like, you're saying that, like...
They're actually based off of actual plane designs.
Very cool. Well, yeah, definitely with the fire mode for the Veritex. And again, it's interesting because in the Robotech, it's like fighter mode, then it's Guardian mode, then it's Battleoid mode. And the original SDF Macross, you have, I believe, Valkyrie mode, then Gerwalk mode, and then Battleoid mode, I believe, which I find it funny that they're different names, but like they have the same initial letter for the switches.
But yeah, really love that whole fighter aspect. And then the other Earth forces, which are sort of like the little robots that are primarily used for defense, that are just walkers and battleoids.
Basically red shirts that always die in battles.
that's very, very apropos and very true. Mm-hmm. But I love their designs as well.
Oh yeah, no, they're pretty cool. I mean, I think they're a little more like
active gun artillery.
Well, yeah, yeah. It's like build a robot that'll fight something. I find a little less creative design wise, but I mean that's not really me putting much thought into it. I mean, I think they're fine. They serve their purpose.
Yeah, and then you have the Zentradi ship, which you have a wide range. You have the sort of fighters, which are sort of these triangle looking ships. You have the pods,
right?
Which are, again, and the thing I like most about it is they did these designs of these pods, and really when you see the fighter pods of the Zentradi, you know what show you're watching. They're very distinct designs, and they really lend itself towards part of the iconicity of this series.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to me, the iconic image is the SDF-1. Obviously with all the fighter planes around it, but although I do like the fighters better, it's like for a mecha show, they kind of bleed together for me after a while, except for shows like Gundam Wing, where they're a little fewer specifically taken out of the mold mechas. But because it's the biggest one in the entire series, obviously the SDF-1 kind of like just really, really just speaks to me.
Yeah, but really did like all the little Zentradi in the different, and again, of course, all the space battleships, looked very, very interesting. Let's talk about special effects. What did you think of the special effects?
There were special effects on the show.
Well, animation does have special, explosions, rain, particle effects. Even back in the day of Disney, they had effect animators where, the normal animators would draw, the characters and the backgrounds, and then the effect animators would come in and do things like rain and fire and stuff like that, and shadows. Shadows are part of special effects. I thought the special effects animation was really, really well done.
Well, I see how you have special effects and backgrounds, and seeing as how I have little to say about either, I'll talk about, I think what's closer for me in terms of observation would be the animation. And like I said before, this being of its time in 82, I think that the animation is kind of inconsistent to where it can either be decent, really good, or really bad. But that's true of all cartoons in the 80s, so it's not really something really that I find to be particularly noteworthy. I will say when it's really good, it's awesome, because when you get into like a really well animated space battle, there's a lot of lights, there's a lot of flashing, there's a lot of fast cutting. And you can see a lot of the best of that done in the movie Do You Remember Love? And there are some episodes where, Rick looks weird and it's inconsistent. But, when it's good, it's really awesome. It's really fun to watch.
Yeah. With me, the special effects were really done awesome. They really paid attention to, making sure there were very good effects. Shadows were in its proper place. The explosions looked good. It could be worse. It could be purple smoke, like it is in Gundam. But the explosions looked realistic, and then to quickly translate with the backgrounds and stuff, the backgrounds looked beautiful. They had a very painted style to them that I very much enjoyed, and I did love the variety, because I can speak today, but because you had an island in the Pacific Ocean, you had a city in Canada, You had
which went bye-bye in episode 19.
Yeah, and different planets in space, including Mars and Saturn. And, you know, I thought they portrayed them all really, really well.
Well, I do like the global nature of the fact that, like, Minmay is half Japanese, half Chinese. So there's an episode where he flies to, it's not Hong Kong, is it?
It's Yokosama, Japan.
Okay, it's in Japan, yeah, because her parents
are in Japan, right. But they live in Chinatown.
And when she's with her aunt and uncle, she dresses like a Chinese woman, which is actually kind of confusing because she's that half of an ethnicity and adopts certain things, especially during the movie comes out.
Yeah, and she goes home to see, you know, her father, her mother, and Super Bitch.
You mean Cousin Kyle?
Yeah. Can you tell I really don't like that character, by the way?
That's an interesting name. I think most people would describe that name to Minmay, but
we'll get into that. Trust me.
I hope we do.
Because God, I have memories of being laughed out of Robotech panels for liking Minmay. So.
That's a disappointing image. Robotech panels kicking someone out.
Well, they didn't kick me out, but I said, "Well, I really like Robotech, and I really like Minmay," and everybody laughing.
We'll get into it.
Yeah, we'll get into it, which is very coming up soon because, we're going to take a short break now because we're done with animation. I'm going to play a couple of promos, which is going to include Mr. Rick Hunter theme playing in the background, Donovan Morgan Grant's Dragon Ball Z podcast, and just with our good friend Jesse Garrett. But after the promos, we'll come back and we will tackle acting and story.
The funeral is over. Jonathan Kent is on the mend.
So, how's Clark's father?
Oh, much, much better.
Lois has returned home.
Lois, over here!
Harry, wife? Since when did you start meeting your staff at the airport? How'd you know I was returning on that flight?
A good editor checks out his hunches, Lois. I got a hot story I want you on straight away. I'm parked over here.
But just as Metropolis has learned to live without the Man of Steel...
I know, there was only one Superman, but Metropolis just hit the jackpot. Because we got four Supermen now, and nobody knows which of them, if any, is the real McCoy.
Four beings of incredible power and intellect have laid claim to the Man of Steel's name.
The last son of Krypton.
I live.
The Man of Steel.
Man of Steel coming through! Nobody move! This is a bust!
The Cyborg.
Yes, I'm Superman. I'm back.
The Boy of Steel.
Put me down!
Listen, pal, don't ever call me Superboy. Capiche?
The reign of the Superman is upon us, and so from crisis to crisis, a Superman podcast begins its epic coverage of this last act in the epic Death and Return of Superman saga. Every week, Michael Bailey and Jeffrey Taylor, along with the best and the brightest in the podcasting community, will cover this event in all of its forms, from the comics to the novelizations, to the audio drama, and beyond. Superman is back, but is any of them the real Man of Steel? Find out on From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast, located at www.supermanhomepage.com and www.supermanpodcastnetwork.com.
I guess you weren't so tough after all, were you? Now it's time to send you to the next dimension.
291 original episodes.
This can't be! It's still going up!
325 manga chapters.
You act innocent, but you're deadly.
Time to die!
Dozens of characters, hundreds of enemies, and a whole lot of violence.
That kind of violence is pointless!
You see, Super Saiyans tend to be a bit violent.
Oh, crap!
Join hosts Donovan and Jesse as they cover the arrival of the Saiyans, the journey to Namek, the battle with Frieza, the mystery of the androids, and the terror of Majin Buu. The Next Dimension, a Dragon Ball Z podcast. Join the fight at dbznextdimension.libsyn.com.
See ya.
In June of 1962, a superhero unlike any other made his first appearance in the pages of Amazing Fantasy number 15, the final issue of that series. 6 months later, this character would receive his own title, and from there he would grow in popularity and be adapted into several animated series, a handful of live-action series, both in the U.S. and abroad, have countless action figures made in his likeness, dominate the cinema screen, and much, much more. It is fair to say that the Amazing Spider-Man is a pop culture icon and a fictional character that people all over the world identify with and love. This year, Spider-Man is turning 50, and Views from the Long Box, an internet radio series hosted by me, Michael Bailey, is going to celebrate the wall crawler in a series of episodes focusing on various aspects of the character's existence. Together with such podcasting luminaries as Brad Douglas, Andrew Leyland, John Wilson, and Scott Gardner, I'm going to give Spidey the biggest birthday card a comic fan could. He may not be my favorite character, but I like him a great deal, and he deserves the spotlight in this, his 50th year. Views from the Long Box can be found at www.viewsfromthelongbox.com. New episodes hit every Friday. Views from the Long Box is a Fortress of Baileytooth production in association with the DiMonzo Corps of Milan, Italy.
Welcome back, folks, and let's get right back into it with acting. So we're going to start with protagonist acting. So what do you think of our protagonists, or at least the voice actors and their job?
We're talking about, like, just solely their acting. Can we get into the characters?
We're solely just talking about the acting.
Well, I mean, I like Rick. I like Mimé for what she does. When I saw this, I recently rewatched this maybe a year or two ago, and I really like Lisa because I think for the kind of character she is, I actually think that in the later dub she comes off as really, I don't want to say the B word, but she comes off as really like less likable than she does in the Harmony Gold dub. Which shows kind of like, you know, for such a character who is portrayed as kind of cold and stern, it shows the talent of the actress to make her not that. So I like that.
I watched the Harmony Gold dub and she came off as a bitch. So
well, there you go. I like her most. I don't think that there's a weak acting bit at all. I mean, I think that the characters are pretty much there in the script, and the voice actors do well.
Yeah, I mean, I love it too. Yeah, as much as I make fun of Lisa, you know, and again, we'll save that for when we get to the whole romantic angles part. Because, like I said, there are some things that just, it's not just her, there's a lot of people that deserve the B word for them for some of the things they do. But Tony Oliver did a wonderful job, really. I love the sort of unique sort of voice in it and sort of subtlety in it, like this very cheerful fellow. But subdued at the same time, and, you know, has his worries. The maturity that was given to Lisa Hayes by Melina McQueen, Reba West, you know, what she did with Mimé, I thought was really great. I thought she did a great job of portraying this very young woman who, you know, not that she was blind to the world, but she was being shielded from the world, I think is a better way to say it. You know, I think a lot of people look at Mimé as being ditzy and ignorant to the world around her, but I don't, you know, considering the people around her, I think it was more of a case of her being shielded. And I really thought, Reba West, a.k.a. Rebecca Forsett, did a wonderful job portraying that. Dan Warren, as Roy Fulker, again, he had this very Big Brother aspect to him that I very much liked. Clam Clark, Max Sterling, wonderful job. Just such a lovable character.
You know what else Clam Clark has done?
What else?
Well, actually, I think he voiced the character from the video game, like the new character, I forgot his name. He did that. I am aware, thanks to Wikipedia, that he's voiced on some English dub Yaoi shows.
Oh, I can look it up right now since you've now.
We don't have to look it up right now. You just look it up in the spare time.
Well, in Robotech, he was Max Sterling and Lance Belmont. In Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, he was Leonardo and Rocksteady. In Metal Gear Solid, he was Liquid Snake. Excuse me. In 2002, in the He-Man and the Masters of the Universe, he was Prince Adam / He-Man. In Painkillers, he was Daniel Gardner. In Tales of Symphony, he was Kratos Orin. Let's see. Oh my god, he was Canada in one of the early Akira dubs.
Awesome.
Canada! Oh, Canada.
Go on.
Awful minute. I can't help it. It's a long-standing joke. Oh wow, he's in the Marvel anime X-Men as Professor X.
Really?
Yes, he's apparently the English voice of Professor X in the Marvel X-Men Marvel anime that just came out.
Interesting, because I've not only seen the Wolverine one.
Yeah. And the cartoons, the list goes on and on. Oh my god, he was in Megas XLR. This is so awesome.
I think I knew that, yeah.
Again, back to what we were talking about. It's not naughty of you, Don, to derail me.
I'm a bad little boy.
Yeah. And, of course, Richard Epcar, I love Ben Dixon. Just such a fun aspect to his voice.
Really?
No, but well,
I love Ben Dixon, too. Really. I just find it funny because, like, he's... You gotta understand, when I was watching as a kid, like, he was very notable. And, like, I like him, too, but I've never heard anybody actually say that they like him. I do.
He's a lovable goof.
Yeah, he is.
And I think, and it really does add to when he dies, making it a sorrowful scene. Because you see somebody that, is really a part of the team go, and it's really is sad. Claudia did a wonderful job as well.
Mm-hmm.
I know there have been some African American characters in American cartoons before, but I think one of the first big roles in an animation of an African American character in a serious animation.
Well, I mean, what other serious cartoons were out around this time? I don't think there was any, really.
Because
you really can't count G.I. Joe or Transformers.
It was before Transformers and before G.I. Joe, and more in the sense, the only shows I can think of American animation really of the past 20, 30 years were sort of comedy shows, like the Hanna-Barbera shows with Scooby-Doo and that stuff. And the only thing I can think about is the character from Josie and the Pussycats.
Who's recently married Archie.
Yep. But, I thought Iona Morris did a wonderful job portraying her character. Let's move on to our antagonists. Well, actually, you had Mira as well. She starts out as an antagonist but becomes a protagonist. And I loved her evolution as a character in the voice as well, her slowly coming to the light side, to put it in a way.
I don't think it was all that slowly, but I liked it anyway.
Well, it was slowly for an animation of this time.
I think it was essentially in one episode, like, she she fights Max. Like, no. First of all, she spies on Max playing a video game. She challenges to a video game. She loses. She gets in a knife fight with him and, like, loses that
somehow.
Then
the episode, at the beginning of the next episode, gets in a fight. oh, we fought, oh, let's get married. But we'll get into that more because that's more story.
Right.
But, you know, with that being said, let's actually get into antagonists. And what did you think of the antagonists?
Characters or
voice.
The acting.
Yeah, the acting.
Well, just because, like, you know, mainly for the antagonists, their voices are kind of distorted because to accentuate their alienness, they're kind of, like, really like, kind of this hollow echo. I like it because I think that's a neat way, especially for the – it's very 80s, but then again, it's effective. And I think it works well because Britai and Exidor aren't really villains. And I would say that, like, Dolza, to a certain extent, isn't either. So they're kind of played as – being sort of like, they're not played as, you know, mustache twirling Dick Dastardlies. They're kind of played as, you know, these very scientific people who are analyzing the situation in a war that they've kind of found themselves in.
And that's something that I like is, you know, they are this warrior race, but my favorite scenes are the ones where they're trying to coincide their warrior aspect of their race with these, basically these emotions, these new feelings that they feel similar with the Micronians with. Really, the only very dastardly person that really is out to get him is Kieran.
Yeah, because he's basically a dick. I mean, really,
yeah.
I don't think any of the characters, I mean, unless they're under his orders, I don't think any of the characters nearly as evil as he is.
Yeah, he's the evilest. But, and again, like I said, that Prince Lothar, that's his name.
Who?
From Voltron.
Oh,
the prince's name is Lothar.
Oh, yeah.
Which I was trying to think, like, if I just go away from it, I'll finally remember it later. But yeah, he did have that Prince Lothar type of feel, like, where I don't care what the orders are, we're going to attack. And he did come up with these dastardly plans that would almost work.
I think pretty much once Chiron's established, because he's not introduced right away, but once you first see him, I believe in episode 7, pretty much all of his schemes are basically disobeying Britai and just attacking for no real reason.
Well, he's attacking because, you know, he can't stand to lose.
Right, exactly. I hate to lose, but I love a challenge.
And now he's over 9,000.
I wasn't going to say that. It makes no sense.
But, I do jokes that don't make sense, so.
That is true.
But with that being said, let's finally move on to the story. And let's start with the main plot of the Robotech Wars and, you know, just the overall thing of the ship doing the space fold, trying to get back, and at the same time trying to figure out what's going on around them with the Zentradi attacking.
Well, I mean, we were talking about the first quote-unquote season, which is like episode 20. The way I see Robotech and the way I've kind of described it to people, and I think the way it's sort of like, I don't want to say advertised, but like in its history is kind of known as, is sort of like an intergalactic, you know, space opera battle that's eventually, or at least undercut in the background by a love story, in my opinion. And it's not like it's a soap opera to where, like, you know, all you care about is love story. You know, much of the plot is in the centerpiece of the war and how, you know, which way it sways. But I think a lot of that is supplemented by the fact that people's emotions are going on. And characters change that's implemented by, you know, like love in the face of war, which sounds really cheesy, but honestly, if once you see it, and anybody who's not seen it, if they see it, you can see how kind of poetic it is. The movie Do You Remember Love really plays this up. It's a lot more, that one's more of like a romance than it is, but it also kind of condenses the overall story. But I would say that, like, in terms of story, I really like it. It's not so much a simple story that you can kind of define immediately, but the best way I would go about it is basically an intergalactic space opera in the background of a love triangle. Essentially, that's how I would do it.
That's very interesting because you actually tackled a lot of things that we'll talk into different plot points, which we'll be talking about in a couple minutes for each. But, you know, for me, it's just, you know, again, I really love the sort of military aspect of them trying to get back to Earth. And I love that there is this large focus on this war that they're basically happening. And, you know, the Zentradi, we have to warn them about the threat. We have to make them understand that the Zentradi are a threat. And then when they finally get to Earth, it's because they've been out so long and they start to understand their enemy. Now they're trying to make the Earth understand they're a threat, but maybe we can have talks with them. And just sort of that natural, I think, evolution about war from a military aspect.
Yeah, because these Zentradi, in large part, aren't evil. They're trying to, you know, they're dealing with humans as they are, you know, like naive, uneducated aliens. But they're dealing with them later on a little more diplomatically. And they're not, like, it's sort of a war through through miscommunication. And a war,
yeah.
You know, but it's sort of a natural war, but it's not like they're the antagonists, but they're only antagonists because the viewers happen to be human. But yeah. And I like the way they play it because Britai and Xtor truly aren't bad guys. They're just on the opposite side.
Yeah, and it really is fun because, you know, in the actual Macross timeline, the Zentradi events do assimilate with Earth. And sort of the Earth population is a mix of Zentradi warriors and Earthlings.
Yeah. I mean, you'll see, you know, you'll see some of the characters even take military positions on the Republic Defense Forces.
But with that, you know, because you did say something interesting, calling the space opera, I actually look at it more like a military documentary, sort of dramatized documentary, and I think that really is important because that is our next point of talking about how it is. At least in my mind, I do feel. It's like a military dramatized documentary with some soap opera bits put in. But really, and we'll be talking about this later, but you know, the big difference I feel between Gundam and the Macross series, which is, you know, is the Robotech series, is the fact that Gundam is more of a war drama where Macross and Robotech is more military documentary.
See, I would disagree with that because I think that primarily, at least with Gundam Wing, that one's a lot more, I would say that one's a lot more pragmatic towards diplomacy in war. I mean, when you think of characters like Relina Peacecraft, her main role isn't so much like a love interest for Hero as it is like a diplomat of peace and trying to end the war. And I think that a lot of the characters' personalities are reflected through the war. And you can say that with Robotech 2, but I think a lot of that gets a little bit more personal. I think I would honestly just switch up the documentary. I wouldn't necessarily use the word documentary, but if we're using that phrase, now I would kind of switch it towards at least specifically Gundam Wing and have the space opera related towards Robotech more personally for me.
Maybe dramatization is maybe a better word to use, would you say?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say as much. I mean, a documentary is. I mean, I think that's sort of like you can use that, but I think that like a better sense to describe it would be sort of like just sort of like a chronological ongoing
timeline.
Story. I mean, I'm trying to think of the way the sequential storytelling a bit is what I was trying to say.
Well, you know, the thing I'm saying it is more of a military. And not just a documentary into what the military is doing, but what the individual characters are doing and sort of looking at their life. And there are, you know, sort of space opera and sort of dramatic moments in it. I'm not denying that, but I'm just saying there seems more of a focus on, you know, here's the timeline of events they're being told, especially with the narration behind it. With Gundam Wing, yes, Relina does provide that sort of pacifist role that she does. But there's a lot more to her character, and they show a lot more to her character, and that's where the whole drama comes in. You know, one of my favorite scenes with Relina is one where she's overlooking, she has to go to this party for Romerfeller, and she's overlooking the party that Romerfeller was having in the ballroom and going, I could burn this place to the ground, but God wouldn't forgive me.
Oh, I don't even remember that. Did she say in the English version?
Yeah, she says that in the English version.
Wow, I have no memories of that.
But, you know, and when was the last time you actually watched Gundam Wing?
Oh, it's been years. It's been years. Yeah. I remember them. I remember them referencing God, but I don't remember her ever saying something that awesome.
Yeah, well, I really suggest watch Gundam Wing, and I'm sure you'll see it. And you'll understand what I'm talking about, it being more of a drama than people probably would. Especially if you haven't watched it in years. You might not remember it as that, but it really is more dramatic than people give it credit for.
Well, I remember it being dramatic in places. I mean, I don't want to say that like it's just a cold, sterile military show. But if you were to compare it to Robotech, a lot of...
When I'm comparing it to Robotech, though, I'm comparing the whole Gundam franchise.
Can you even do that, though? Because you're putting, like, 20-odd series against one story. That's 36 episodes. Or maybe...
Well, we'll be doing that later, but I'm just saying in a generalization, especially when you look at the original Mobile Suit Gundam as well, the original Mobile Suit Gundam seemed more about the drama on the ship rather than Robotech, which was more balanced.
I would disagree with that, too. I mean, I think that kind of wings a lot more emotionally resonant towards Mobile Suit Gundam. And but in fairness, I remember Mobile Suit Gundam even less, although I did watch that. But
Well, I'm saying from my experience, and I'm talking, you know, that's really the only thing that can compare to Robotech / Macross, you know, on an individual basis, is the original Mobile Suit Gundam, which did come out around the same time.
Yeah, I think it may have come out later. But I mean, if you want to compare the entirety of the Gundam franchise against Robotech, we would have to incorporate Southern Cross and Masapita as
well.
Yeah.
Well, we'll do that later because we do have that as a talking point.
Okay.
Yeah. But I'm just saying for that, and I guess that's just a difference of you know how we're viewing the series, which is perfectly understandable. I'm just saying from my standpoint, I see it more, like I said, in a documentary aspect. Now let's talk to here's the goody part, folks. Let's talk about
love. Shippers.
you what?
I love shippers. That's the part we're talking about, right?
Shippers?
Well, I mean, that's basically like the as I see in your script, the romantic angles of the plot.
Am I the only one disturbed the fact that in this series we show an entire ship of males along with an entire armada of Zentradi lusting after a 16-year-old girl?
Well, it's Japan, so, I mean...
Oh, now that's a low blow.
That's absolutely fair.
No. What? Okay, that stuff happened later, okay? It wasn't like that in this time.
Well, I mean they were confused at first. They don't even know what love and lust is at first.
But that joke aside, really there's three sort of romantic parts. You know, there's the love triangle that's between Rick and Minmay and Lisa, and if you want to include Super Bitch, it's a four-way.
Wow.
Yeah.
maybe not for the overarching story, but like at one point it does kind of get to that because Lisa is attracted to Kyle. Kyle's attracted to Minmay, which is weird because he's a cousin. And Rick's attracted to Minmay, doesn't seem to be attracted to anybody, but she is attracted to Rick eventually.
We'll talk about it in a second. And then you have Max's and Minera's romance, and of course, Claudia and Roy's romance. And let's start with Claudia and Roy's, which...
That is, like, the earliest, I think.
What?
That might be the earliest that's not Minmay and Rick in the series.
Yeah, well, but my whole same point I was going to say is this, like, really the first sort of interracial relationship that they're showing in animation?
You would know better than I, but it's the earliest one that I'm aware of. I mean, because again, like you said, there's not that many...
because I can't really think of it. And I was thinking about that, and I was like, wow, that's really neat. I think this is like the first interracial relationship being portrayed in an animation on screen. And that's a big step forward. I mean...
Well, what I like about it is the fact that, like, no comment is made towards it. Nobody talks about it.
And that is the great thing about it is that really no comment is made towards it. It's really us as a fans because of the culture we live in, especially during that time when this came out, of it being interesting.
What's also sad, the fact that, like, I don't think people, I mean, ideally you would be around that time, but, like, again, the series takes place, like, when I think between 2009 and 2012. I don't think people would care as much, but like the fact that like it is such a non-issue. I mean, also to a lesser tangent, there's a lot of women in power in the show, and that's not really brought up as a talking point either. I mean, it's once or twice it is when you get like male.
But I like that as well. But I also like the fact that our like one scene of nudity in Robotech happens with a scene of Roy and Claudia.
What? This is,
okay, there's a scene where Claudia comes in to try to wake Roy up, which eventually leads to him slapping her on the ass and implied that he basically pulls her into bed. Yeah, the poster on the wall.
I do remember that. Well, I mean, there's another scene that you forgot about, which I thought that was what you were going to bring up, like in episode 4.
Mimei's ass.
Or, I mean, yeah. I think she's actually. I think you see some full frontal in the movie. But I mean, we're not counting the movie.
Yeah, we're not counting the movie because I didn't watch the movie. But I had her butt when she went to shower. But I actually don't consider that nudity, only because if they can freaking show Dexter's ass at the end of an episode of Dexter's Laboratory on Cartoon Network.
Well, I mean, I don't
consider showing the buttocks as nudity. But
I barely count a picture, but it's neither here nor there.
But boobies for sure.
We're talking about romance, though.
Yeah, but I was just making a joke about it because I found it funny. But yeah, I love sort of their relationship. I love how natural it felt. And I really love sort of how sorrow that you felt when Roy died, and just how – and really what made the scene so sorrowful was him dying in her room. My only issue with that scene – here it comes – is if a – I would have to believe – because they do show military rules being enforced all throughout the series – I would have to imagine that any pilot that would come in with his fighter being that damaged and there being bullet holes in the cockpit window, I would imagine he would be checked out first before he was allowed to go to his quarters.
You know what? I'm surprised, because that's actually a very fair point that you made. I was expecting to challenge you on it, but that's actually – because there was blood in the seat, and the guys in the garage were like, notice.
I mean, did nobody help him out? Did he just like, oh, I'm fine, jumped out and walked to the quarters?
I remember in the Comico comic book adaptation, they're like, wow, the guy must be dead on his feet. And then they cut to him dying. It's like.
But it just seems strange. Like, nobody's going to check him out. It's the only reason I have issue with his death scene is it was a preventable death. And it's a huge, for me, for that death scene, it's a plot hole. That's really major.
I don't think. No. I would not call it a major pothole, but I think that I agree with you that, like, it was a prevent. Because you think he went all the way to her place to have pineapple salad. So you would imagine that, like, maybe if he's not bleeding, he would still kind of be like, you can't walk with three bullet holes in your back from a gigantic robot gun.
Yeah, I have a hard time believing that, though. I saw the salad. It looked like a normal salad. So I think when he said pineapple salad, he was talking about something else.
Well, I mean, in the Japanese version, the episode is called Pineapple Salad, which is a little more evoked.
Suggest? Oh.
No, not suggest.
I just found it funny, because you had the scene earlier where Lisa goes, pineapple salad? Yeah. What's pineapple salad?
Yeah, it's, you know, like I'm in the mood for pineapple salad. It's just, what is that? And Claudia.
In essence, Ben's death is so much better because it's really sorrowful because he just couldn't outrun the blast.
That one is a lot more sad to me. I mean, Roy's is sad. That one was like so. I remember seeing that, and this is why episodes 18 and 19 stick up for me. Not only because two characters. First of all, episode 19 is a big deal because they're kicked out of Earth because of that, because like their shield freaking explodes, like nuking part of Canada, and literally Rick. But
well, as long as all they did was nuke Ottawa, I'm fine with it. But that's
well, it's Toronto, but like I mean, they're trying to outrun the blast, and I mean I forgot about this because I saw this again recently. I forgot about this. You see. You see the guy. You see him in his cockpit, literally like it. Get incinerated. You don't see his plane blow up. You see him fry to death.
And well, you see the plane slowly being blown up, and then it cuts to him being incinerated, which is sad.
But, dude, I remember them showing that on Toonami. I was like, Jesus Christ! Like I didn't say it when I was a kid, but like it's like, good God! And like when Rick is like, my God, man! Like he makes a sign of the cross. Like they really take death seriously in the show, and I'm glad that like in the Harmony Gold dub. They didn't cut any of that out because a lot of the violence was kept in the show, and it's kind of sticking your head as a kid.
Just one more thing on the death before we go back to romance, but the thing I think that really also helped the scene was the fact that I don't think you expected another major character to die the very next episode after a major character died.
Absolutely. That's just right afterwards, like.
And so it keeps you on your heels for the rest of the series.
Yeah, which I love that. I mean, you know, as a fan, you're like, oh, as a fan, you're like, wow, God, that's awful. But, like, you can't refute how brilliant that is because, first of all, this is war. Not every main character's going to live. And then, like, it was so unexpected. You could not – it's impossible to see that coming.
Yeah. But back to romance, Max and Mira is next, the fastest – from first meeting to marriage I've ever seen.
They're married in the very same episode that they – I won't say they meet, but like – I think there's a time skip, but like, yeah.
And, well, obviously, like, they met on the battlefield, so they're trying to connect it to that. But really, the first time they meet is in the arcade. That night, they have a date. She tries to kill him, and apparently, if you really want to turn on Max Sterling, come at him with a knife. Because he'll just marry you on the spot.
Because Max is awesome. Well, I mean, what I like about that is that there's a lot of things I like about this. Is that when he's like the next after first of all, why does he ask her to marry her? Marry him? That's kind of questionable. But like he tells Rick, and Rick's like, this is nonsense. I can't believe you're doing this. And then like she shows up, and he like takes back every word he says.
Well, my thing is you know me. I love classic comedy gags and bits, and a spit take, you can't get more classic than the spit take. And it's that thing, too, like, he's coming up to her, and he has coffee, and you're like, here comes the spit take. And you can just see it coming a mile away. He says, I'm gonna get married.
I was like, to his Entrati girl, I think, too. I forgot what makes him spit it out, but.
Well, but in, really, again, going back to sort, and even though it's, here's really where it's talked about sort of the interracialness. Because I think there is sort of a sort of sub.
Well, there's a scene. I was actually going to bring this up. There was a scene in the wedding where Global makes a speech, and at first he's like, you know, like this wedding is going to like really. At first he insinuates that like it's an immoral thing to do, and everybody's like, Global, you douchebag. But then he talks about how this brings apart and could possibly end the war, and it's a really really good scene because it's a lot like that, how romance is reflecting off of the war.
Yeah, it's Rick who's like, Admiral, how could you? It's like, yeah, Admiral, how could you? Where the are you going with this?
Right.
Cause like, and it took a while to get there, but it's like, oh, I see where you're going.
Yeah, exactly.
With that,
kind of dickish on his part, too.
With that, let's talk about the four-way between Rick, Lisa, Minmay, and Superbitch.
You want to get that out of your system first?
I hate Kyle. I fucking hate Kyle.
Well, honestly, it's hard not to hate Kyle, because he's not... Let's list this.
He's a douchebag.
Yeah, he doesn't. Well, I'm gonna say like he when we first introduced him, he doesn't like Rick because he's a pacifist. He's a pacifist who doesn't like the military. And then in the very next episode, he's beating up people in a restaurant, which is awesome. But like
these are the times, by the way, where I kind of hate Rick's sort of attentiveness because I just want to see somebody grab Kyle by the neck and go, jackass, look out there. You want to go wave a white flag? They're not going to care. They're going to kill you. We're not doing this because we like war. We're doing this because we like to survive.
They all say that to his face the first time he mentions that. Like,
yeah.
I didn't sign up for the war to kill people. I signed up because...
But he keeps doing it. It's like, dude, really? And, like, I love that when Minmay's, you know, and again, she's Miss Macross and she's in the hospital. It's like, oh, why do you care about some, you know... actress, you know, you should care more about trying to stop this war. I'm like,
it's the same episode when Ben dies, like literally,
yeah,
she's in the hospital for bullshit reasons, and like, and everybody's like, how is Minmay? How's Minmay? Who cares about my cousin whom I love dearly? Let's talk about the war.
Yeah, and then we should stop it. And and then with Minmay, and again, this is the whole reason why I say shielded is like, she's in the hospital, she doesn't know there was a fight, and she doesn't know that, you know, Ben died or anything like that. But there's these moments to where, and this is why
Rick,
I think.
How you doing, Rick? You want to visit me? He can't even talk to her.
but she seems like she's all about herself. And this is why I think people hate her so much is that she'll have these moments to where, really, if you look at it, it's not her fault. She doesn't know this stuff. But at the same point in time, because of what you know, it makes her look horrible.
Well, this is one last thing I think we should mention about Kyle, which is important, is the fact that, like, he he hits on her, and, like, I don't think he's ever outright said how much he's attracted to her, but, like, I remember specifically, I don't know if you got up to this episode or not, but, like, I think episode 24 or whatever, when the SDF one is attacked, and, like, he kisses Minmay, and Rick sees it, and gets pissed off, but, like, he shows his attraction, and I think it was Druk at the time or whatever. I know when he leaves the series.
Well, yeah, and for years, this is why I've defended Minmay and sort of the relationship between her and Rick Hunter is that the relationship between her and Rick Hunter, the reason why it didn't work was not because they weren't made for each other, but because everybody kept getting in the way. But it really is true.
Shut up.
Like, by Kyle, it's like Kyle did everything to make them hate each other.
What are you talking about? Really... That never happened. do you remember? He's not in the. I think he leaves like in the third to second to last episode or something like that. Like he's not there. It's not because of Kyle that Minmay didn't hook up with Rick Hunter. At least primarily not. I mean, he did have.
I'm not saying primarily, but I'm saying there's a lot of things, and it's just like with their relationship, it just everything seemed to. There always seemed to be something that got in the way between them being together.
I will say that, like, he didn't play a factor in because if it wasn't for Kyle, like, there's an episode where they're trying to see the movie, and Lisa's attracted to Kyle, and Rick's attracted to Minmay, and they kind of, Rick and Lisa kind of get even closer than they have been before because they both share sadness and knowing that the people they're attracted to are attracted to each other, and then they kind of form their own relationship based off of that. So I guess in some way, Kyle is responsible. But like saying, if he hadn't have done this, I mean, the way you phrased it just sounded so hilarious.
Probably the way he phrased it. But you know, what I'm just saying is like, you know, because for years, and this is what I mean by getting laughed at Robotech panels, because I would defend Minmay, and it really is this thing. So again, she's shielded. It's not so much that she's absent-minded or that she doesn't know better or that she doesn't see what's right in front of her.
Mm.
Let's
talk about Minmay because I don't hate Minmay either. In fact, like, I
really feel sad for her.
Okay, well, you know what? Here's my thing. Because when I was a kid, I obviously hated Minmay because Minmay is annoying. She can be annoying. I mean, like, it's not so much that, like, you know, what she does. Whatever. I mean, I don't hate her. But when I was a kid... It's hard. I mean, I think maybe if you're a little girl, it's easier. But like, because she's really played up to be dumb. But it wasn't until I watched the series again recently and I saw Do You Remember Love that I really felt bad for her. I really do because she didn't ask for the life she ended up. She's one of those. I mean, she's played up as one of these people who like regrets celebrity after it happens. But
yeah, I mean, she wanted to initially. Join it, but decided not to because she was with Rick. It was the mayor who entered her in, and everybody voted for her, and she was just thrust in with this personality, which really hurt her relationship with Rick.
Well, she's a teenager, first of all. She's like the youngest character in the show. Like,
yeah.
She enjoyed the thing,
16.
But like she, after a while, she grew tired of it, and then by the end of the series, she found out that the only person she could always rely on was Rick Hunter, and she loved him, but. By that point, so many things happened.
It was too late.
Yeah, but so many things have happened that, like, it wasn't so simple. I mean,
really, that's the thing of their relationship to where, it's, you know, you have Rick and, you know, the things he's going through of the horrors of war combined with the forced stardom onto Minmay, add the fact of their young age. That really hampers them and makes them sometimes do dumb decisions and doesn't make them or makes them sort of emo, I think is the best way you can put it.
Yeah.
But I mean, you think, you know, where like they're very indecisive a lot of times.
Well, I mean,
you add all of that along with, you know, so many things, so many people getting in the way of them just trying to be together for a Saturday night, even. It's what led to the downfall of their relationship.
Well, it reminds me of episode 17, which I know you skipped, but I know you've seen before, where, like, a lot of times, at the beginning of the series, Rick is totally on Minmay, and actually, there's a point where, like, he has a nightmare that Lisa's preventing him from that. But if you ever watched the movie Do You Remember Love, which is a condensed movie of Robotech, or SCF Macross, in that one, it's condensed in a way that, like, where... Rick, Lisa, Kyle, and Minmay are kidnapped by the Zentradi, and I think I forgot whether I think Rick and Lisa are separated and then from Minmay and Kyle, and Rick and Lisa form a relationship after Rick started forming with Minmay, and when Minmay and Kyle come back and she runs to Rick, he's already with Lisa, and there's a big scene where it's literally like a scene of awkwardness where she's trying to get back to him and he's already gone with her, and that's sort of a condensed version of how it kind of plays in the show, which is different because I would say after watching again, the last like 10 episodes are pretty much on the triangle, and it's a lot of indecisiveness. It's a lot of indecisiveness on Rick's part, to be fair. And yeah. I mean, we're kind of going.
Rick's actually the indecisive one, and I completely understand the relationship. I mean, that being said, and this is why I really feel sad for Minmay, why I talk so much about, you know, really the bad rap she gets and how this people got in the way of her relationship, is I really completely understand why Lisa and Rick get together, especially with them being on the being caught by the Zentradi and them having to. It's like, maybe it's because I've been watching far too much modern anime, but I half expected that scene to go to a certain place.
Oh, shut up.
It's like, I was half expecting, like, and you make children this way? No, we do it this way. It's like, show us. I don't remember this scene on Toonami.
I hope that's not. I hope there's not any doujin that's done that.
Oh, I am sure to God.
That's because, episode 12 and 13, episode 11, 10, 11, 12, and 13, I think, is the one where, Rick and Lisa first get to know each other, because it's actually very combative. I mean, he says, you know, she's an old lady.
And that's the thing. It is this thing to where they are very combative with each other and, old sourpuss, and it's like, ugh.
Well, I mean, Lisa, after watching again, Lisa's the character that I actually, she was my favorite character after my second viewing. As an adult, because I found her to be a lot more sympathetic. I mean, Rick's awesome, but by the end, his indecisiveness can kind of
hinder his character.
It does, yeah, it does hinder his character. Whereas Lisa, honestly, is trying to let her emotions out and try to express them after years of not doing so, partly for the military, partly because of what happened with Carl Ribber. And I find her to be a really, really. I mean, I think all three characters are empathetic. I think Minmay is a lot more sympathetic than I think people are willing to let her out to be. But I think Lisa is the most sympathetic because she honestly, she's just a person who's trying to live her life and do what she wants.
Well, I think a lot of people love her more because, you know, they come to love her because she starts out as, you know, she is bitchy. You know, she purposely does all these things to Rick and forces these missions on him just because he called her sourpuss.
I don't know if she forces missions on him, but she does. I mean, him being a young pilot kind of gets to her in a way that a lot of people don't because of the whole authority thing. I remember one time he yells at her about, you know, being callous towards missions because of certain safety issues. I mean, they're very combative, but their combativeness also reveals certain tenderness that they both can share in terms of emotional resonance.
Yeah, and I remember it's just one of my favorite scenes. This is where I feel the relationship does change. She's just being this bitchy self to him when he wants to bring Ben back, because he's basically leaking gas.
Yeah, see, that's what I was thinking about. And she's like,
No, he stays out. I'm like, he's leaking rocket fuel. One spark and we've lost Ben. We have shish kebab Ben for dinner. Okay? Let him bring him in.
And then he's like, you know, you may not have seen the damage of space can do to a man, but I have. And later on, I think when they're attacked and she sees that, that starts to stick with her.
Oh, absolutely.
There are also times where, you know, she tries so hard to get to know him. She tells him that Roy died. She visits him in the hospital. There's that one episode. Do you remember this episode where, near the end, where, Rick goes on a date with him at the same time? There's that episode where he makes a date with Lisa and makes a date with Minmay on the same day, and it's like, oh, the hijinks. But it really is, well done, because...
That may have been after episode 25.
Yeah, that's near the end, because that's in the last...
Yeah.
So, and it's really good because it shows almost futility of the relationship.
Rick.
Yeah.
Of Rick's romantic life. But I think the final thing to say about all, you know, all four of them, or should I say all three of them, because
yeah, it's for three of them, yeah.
Let's because let's keep Mr. Super, you know what, Kyle, who I want to go all Ralph Crandon on and go pow right to the moon. But what was that?
Nah, I was laughing.
You didn't expect me to go all Ralph Crandon, did you?
What were you gonna say?
But, you know, I was going to say, I think this shows you just how well the relationships are done in this series by the fact that we've been sitting here talking about 15, 20 minutes just about Rick, Min-May, and Lisa.
Well, the series ends with that being resolved, and the series ends, like, with those three main characters' stories coming to the forefront. It's really not – by the end of the series, honestly –
or at least the Macross version.
Yeah, the Macross, exactly. I mean, by the end of the Macross story, it's not – so much about the war. It is about, you know, who's going to be with who. And, like, as soap operas as that is, that is totally sort of, like,
and then, of course, in Robotech 3, the Sentinels, you have that scene where, you know, of course, Rick is now the admiral of the SDF-1, Lisa's with him, and Min-May has come to help them out, I guess, for their anniversary or something.
I've actually not seen the Sentinels.
You've not read the Sentinels?
No, I may have read it as a kid, but I'm not actually.
Dark Horse Comics, it actually is really, really good.
I'm sure it is. My Robotech thing is that, like, I have, like, 90% of the comic run. I've read all the whole series in the novels they had. I forgot what the company was, but I read the paperback novels. I've actually done the same thing with I've seen all of Southern Cross, Robotech Masters, and I've read those novels too. Although not since I was a kid, not since like 1998. And obviously, Macross is the one I go back towards. I've not seen anything of Invin Invasion or Massapedia, but the extra stuff that goes into further like the Macross timeline, I've read about. I've not primarily seen.
Yeah, well, you know, that's a good segue because. We're on to our final two talking points, and the first one is let's talk about Robotech and Macross's place in American animation and its Toonami legacy.
Well, yeah. I mean, I remember being very mad that it replaced Voltron on Toonami at the time because like, that was the show I was into. But I remember watching it begrudgingly because it was something to watch, and I was just so sucked in. And again, I think a lot of it plays – I think Toonami – plays a big part into it because Toonami would play shows that weren't just for kids. I mean, they would, but like their shows would be towards kids and adults. You know, I mean, the anime series, DBZ.
They redefined the action genre, as they said, and it really was that they put these shows that were great action shows that everybody could get into. And I think on the American animation aspect, it is, you know, it along with Voltron really provided a different sense of animation than the typical. Hey, we have this cartoon that's also selling toys for us with Transformers and G.I. Joe and He-Man and, of course, Teenage Mutant Turtles later, even though that also had a comic book aspect to it that really helped it. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, I don't – personally, for me at least, my brother and I watch Robotech and Toonami. I think my cousin as well. I don't actually remember how much of a factor it played in Toonami per se. I know it definitely had a resurgence, but like I think that I know it was very popular when it first came out in America in 1985.
Yeah,
it was whack.
Yeah, it was a mid-season replacement for Voltron, and actually was the first time Toonami did anything on Saturday nights. It was Robotech, where they would basically like show two episodes of Robotech, and they did this for I think 3 months at least. And so that's part of where the resurgence came. But its Toonami legacy is if you didn't have Voltron and didn't have Robotech, I think it would have been harder for people to accept things like Sailor Moon and Dragon Ball Z.
Possibly, because I know Robotech was sort of like me getting...
Because it did provide sort of this beginner's introduction into the art styles that you would see with Sailor Moon and Dragon Ball Z. You really didn't get that with the Thundercats or especially the other shows that were on, which was... The Real Adventures of Johnny Quest, mm-hmm. Reboot, and Beast Wars.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in terms of anime, absolutely. I mean, like, it was Voltron, Robotech, Sailor Moon, DBZ.
which were the first introductions to those art styles and really got people excited in it. And then, like I said, Gundam Wing, which added the really, really wonderful story. Not that this isn't a wonderful story itself, but Gundam Wing story just, you know, that we'll get more into this in the next point, but again, just its popularity. Again, this whole build-up, and it's there because of Voltron, because of Robotech, that we are able to enjoy, sort of art-wise, the next anime series that would come along.
One thing Robotech did do was sort of, like, really push the genre in terms of, like intergalactic wars being shown in animation. Because I know that, like, the whole thing they always did with, like the big-ass missiles kind of, like, going everywhere, that was done by Robotech first.
And the thing is there, you know, you really see the influence of Robotech in Exo Squad.
Okay.
Because if you ever seen the animation Exo Squad, which was early to mid 90s, like, go on to YouTube, Don, and watch the intro to Exo Squad. You'll immediately think Robotech when you see it.
I think I may have heard that before. So I'll just check that out.
Yeah, so definitely there's a legacy that, you know, Robotech and Macross has for both the American animation and Toonami legacy. But final talking point, and I've said this before.
This is basically Robotech versus Gundam Wing.
Well, but, you know, no, really, actually, it's not. It's just really talking about why has, you know, Gundam been more popular here in America than Robotech / Macross, as opposed to in Japan, where they're both immensely popular. Basically, they're the same in Japan. It's really in America where Gundam has taken off more than Macross. And really, just to give people a rundown of what the Macross series is, you know, with Macross, you had Super Dimensional Fortress, which ran from 1982 to 1983. Sure. The movie from 1984. The second movie, Flashback 2012, in 1987. Then you had the 10th anniversary Macross 2 OVA that ran in 1992. You then, in 1994 and 1995, had Macross Plus, the TV sequel OVA, which takes place in 2004. And by the way, Macross 2 takes place in 2092. The original Super Dimensional Fortress storyline stopped in 2012. And the first movie goes to 2031.
That's actually very depressing. Because I remember thinking 2012 is so far away.
Yeah, Macross Plus, the international version, again, 24. 94, 95 had Macross 7, which was a TV series sequel to Macross Plus and continued from that storyline that had a sequel upon itself called Macross Dynamite 7. Then you had Macross Zero, which is the 20th anniversary, which was a prequel to the original 1982 TV series that was done in CG.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Macross 7 itself also had movies, but the Macross Zero was in 2002, Macross Dynamite 7 was 97 to 98, and Macross 7 was 94 to 95. And then you had Macross Frontier in 2007, and there's talks of a new Macross series called Macross 2-9 to celebrate the 30th anniversary. I don't know if it'll be coming out this fall or next year, but this year is actually the 30th anniversary.
Yeah, there was a panel at Comic-Con about that specifically, and I really wanted to go, but I absolutely couldn't.
And then when you look at Gundam, and again, I'm going off this list, Mobile Suit Gundam was started in 1982, followed by Gundam Gundam Zeta, Double Zeta, then you had Gundam 0080, The Pocket War, Gundam 0083, Stardust Memories, then some movies that, like, take place in the future, but then you have Super Deformed Gundam, you have G Gundam, Gundam Wing. Then you have the prequel 8th Mobile Suit Team that takes place, or not prequel, but takes place during the original Mobile Suit Gundam. Then you have Gundam Seed, Gundam Seed Destiny. You have Gundam 00 and its sequel, and now Gundam Unicorn and Gundam Age, for that matter. And it just seems like in America, in the anime community, Gundam is more popular.
I wouldn't be able to talk about that as much because I don't know much about the mecha fan base. I do know, I really do hear a lot of Macross stuff, even if I don't really look out for it. Possibly because Gundam, another Gundam, Mobile Suit Gundam was all on Toonami.
Well, yeah,
I'm not sure if I'm
willing
to say one's popular over the other, because I do hear a lot of both. I hear most of the Gundam stuff from Toonami, I hear most of the Macross stuff just by Radius. I mean, like, I know Macross Plus was popular, I think, because I know, didn't Yoko Kanno do the soundtrack on that?
Yeah, she did the soundtrack on that.
Right.
But I agree with you. That's my conclusion, too, is really it was Gundam Wing, and it was more of the presence of Gundam. I mean, when you think about the fact that you had music videos in the early thousands, like Linkin Park, that had Gundam model kits.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Uh-huh.
And so it really was a thing to where, you know, Gundam Wing, Macross really doesn't have a Gundam Wing. Because,
the SCF Macross is like that.
Well, Macross Plus is closest, but I think one of the things, and I don't know why, is the Japanese not really bringing the rest of the Macross series, and I don't know if it's due to legal wrangling situations because of the Robotech or whatever, but I just think it's a shame because Macross 7 is really good, so is Macross Zero, Macross Frontier, all of this is good, and I think, in fact, I think Macross Frontier would do good on Toonami right now.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, like, they did go back and redub it closer to, like, the non-Robotech done version, so I don't know if it's a legal problem at all.
Yeah, I mean, right now, Manga Entertainment, you know, has both Macross Plus and Macross 2, whoever's in the movies / OVAs out, but outside of that, really all you have is the original Macross through Robotech, and so there's a lot of people, and I'm talking more than just mainstream anime fans, I'm talking beyond that, sort of the casual fan, they know Gundam, but they don't know Macross.
I don't know. I mean,
they know Robotech, but they don't know Macross.
Well, I mean, Macross as a name, they might know. I'm not sure if they might know it from head to toe,
yeah.
But they'll not. I don't think you'll find an anime fan who's never heard of Macross.
I'm talking more of a franchise sense and a popularity of the franchise. I mean, they may know it, but they may not be into it as they are with Gundam.
What would you say is the most popular Gundam series?
Gundam Wing, without a doubt.
You really think so?
Yes. I know so.
I'm not going to disagree, because I don't know. But like,
I mean, I've been to so many anime conventions.
Like, kind of like saying stuff, and I'm not sure what to respond to that because I'm not sure of the fan base. I'm not sure about your reasoning about it. I mean,
what I'm saying, Don, though, is like I've been to, again, anime conventions, and I know you've been to conventions too, but like every time I go to an anime convention, there's a talk about Gundam whatever. Gundam Wing always comes up and the popularity behind it. You know, and it had to have pop because, again, it really is the series, the anime series, that really helped launch that whole generation of fans into anime. Yeah, you had people that were getting into anime because of Dragon Ball Z and Pokemon and Sailor Moon and that stuff, but what really made them want to become anime fans were Gundam Wing because of its storyline. There's a lot of old-school Gundam fans that want to misnomer that because they're kind of like Final Fantasy fans where they want to live in the past and they're like, oh, nothing was better than 5, you know. Mm-hmm. Same thing here. They all want to live in the past of Gundam and Gundam Zeta and Double Zeta. But, you know, Gundam as a franchise was actually, while it had its fans, it was really flailing until Gundam 0083 Stardust Memories, which really amped up the drama, and then Gundam Wing was just the sort of evolution of that.
Hmm.
And there's definitely more knowledge about Gundam than there is about Macross and the anime community.
There's definitely more. See, I don't know how to respond to that, because honestly, that does sound like, if I can be frank, the declarative statements of a Gundam Wing fanboy. But, I mean,
but
I don't have any statistics to work off of that.
But I'll say this, I'm both an equal fan of Gundam and Macross. I will admit I might have maybe a smaller edge towards Gundam, but it's not a thing to where, like, I'm trying to say, oh, Gundam is so much better than Macross, because it's not. I enjoy them both. I love Macross Plus.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not something to where I understand where you can maybe think that, but the fact is it's just not true. You know, I like Macross. Well, like I said, I prefer Gundam maybe a little bit more, but I do like it just as much as I probably do like Gundam. You know? It's just that Macross has not had the type of presence that Gundam has had, I think, on a broader sense.
Well, I mean, I don't know about the presence Gundam's had. I mean, I just know that there are in existence are dozens of titles like Macross. I mean, I think they're comparable in that way. Obviously, as mecha titles, but like when talking about like the impact and fan base, all I know is the prolific nature of the series rather than the individual responses to the series.
Yeah, but again, you have to realize the reason I'm saying this is that the only things that have been licensed and brought to America is the original Macross series, both in Robotech and its original form, the second movie, the first movie for that matter, both by Manga and also by Manga Entertainment, Macross Plus. Macross 7 has never been brought to America. Macross Dynamite 7 has never been brought to America. Macross Zero has never been brought to America.
Wait, really?
Yeah, and Macross Frontier has yet to be brought to America. Whereas pretty much every Gundam series and movie has been brought to America by Bandai.
Hmm. Well, something can be said for that.
So again, not really to sort of say, you know, one's better than the other, just to sort of discuss maybe why one's been, let's say Macross has just been overlooked, unfortunately, which I find sad. But I think that's it. Let's move on to final thoughts as we've hit the 2-hour mark.
Oh yeah, we have, haven't we?
Yes. So what's your final rating for basically Robotech season 1?
I'm not gonna rate the season. I'm just gonna rate the entire series. But like, I mean, like, what are the ratings?
I usually do a 1 to 5.
Yeah, I give it a 5 because it is my favorite anime of all time. Hello. I mean, like, I'm not gonna be dense. A lot of that is off of nostalgia, but having rewatched it again, and you know the old dub, which you know, I mean, you always take it or leave with the dubs, but like watching it again though, it's just, and being aware of like its Japanese counterpart and being aware of like what is and what isn't, and you know, at the end of the day, it's such a wonderful and engaging story that, you know, is just, it's a story that's very well told mostly. I mean, it's a finite story. It has a beginning, middle, and end. But like, I just, for reasons I can't actually articulate, but just I kind of just espouse, I just really enjoy it. And it's this, I mean, the only reason I'm not doing a podcast on that and one on Dragon Ball Z is that like it's not nearly as long to do a podcast on. So I give it a 5. I mean, it's my favorite.
Well, if you ever do, I'll be there to do it with you.
<Shall see.
laughs> But you know, for my ratings, I give it a 4.5 out of 5. It's a very good series. Has great action, great music. There's a couple of things here and there that I guess I can nitpick and I have problems with. Though, you know, the sadness, and I guess this is something I didn't talk about, but sort of the sadness that I have for Rick and Minmay's relationship sort of turned me off, but only in the sense that I feel so sad for their relationship, it sometimes makes me want to stop watching, which I guess shows you the power of that relationship, but same time, when you turn people off to the series because of it, it may be a bit too strong. But, you know, the exception of a few nitpicks here or there, I really do love this series, and it has a great place in the history of Toonami. And a great place in the history of American animation. And I really...
What do you think prevents it from being a 5, just out of curiosity? I mean, it better not be just Kyle.
No, like I said, it's nitpicks here or there with the editing. And it can't all just be the animation. Some of it's Harmony Gold editing is choppy in some places. And
well, yeah, I don't think we ever talked about the fact that like it is legitimately three shows pasted together to be one. And near the end, it gets very obvious that like part of the show is not part of the other is actual continuity.
Yeah,
who cares?
Yeah. But I'm just saying, like, editing wise, like, editing up frames and that stuff, sometimes it's choppy, and I have an issue with that. Pace of the series, which, again, it very much is the pace that most 70s animation have, but it still is a matter of sometimes the pace, it feels like it jumps all over the place sometimes. Yeah, and like I said, the relationship, but it's not just that, you know, I hate Kyle. It's that the strength of the sadness that comes from their relationship, Rick and Mimic, can, you know, sometimes make me want to stop watching the series because I feel so sad about it.
See, I like that, though, because you want to see how it turns out. It's a lot like it.
Yeah. I mean, you do go back to eventually watching it, but it does make you sad. So 4.5 out of 5 for me. So that is it for this long episode of this is actually my first 2-hour episode since I want to say early March. But yeah, thank you for this long episode of Tom's Prerogative. Don, you want to tell people where they can find you?
Here, there, and everywhere. I am the host, or I should say co-host, of the Next Dimension of Dragon Ball Z podcast, which you will hopefully have heard a promo of by now. You can find our show on DBZ Next Dimension at dbznextdimension.libsyn.com, where my co-host Jesse Garrett and myself go over Dragon Ball Z, just basically big chunks of the series chronologically once a month. We just did a 2-part Ginyu Force episode and this month of July. It was a lot of fun. And we're revving it up because Jesse, the gimmick of our show is that Jesse's not known nearly as much about DBZ as I have, so a lot of this is new to him. So check it out with his eyes or relive it with my eyes.
You better make him watch the original, well, 4 episodes to Power Up series.
I am a co-host on Spider-Man Crawl Space. I also do content on that, such as reviews and editorials. I do same thing with Clone Saga Chronicles on Spidey.com, although that's less frequent. So you mainly find me on Next Dimension and Spider-Man Crawl Space. And finally, I am a co-host on the Batman Universe Comic Cast. You can find that at batmanuniverse.net. Those are basically all the pies I have my fingers in.
And I just said that because, you know, I don't like Dragon Ball Z Kai.
We review all versions of the show. We really do.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, yeah, I know that. I'm just saying for my personal preference, I'm an old school fan. It's a rite of passage to make it through 4 long filler issues of them just powering up. That's a rite of passage as an anime fan, as far as I'm concerned. Which, speaking of Dragon Ball Z, you know Team 4-Star, right?
Oh, yeah, love it. Love their stuff.
Did you see the latest Nostalgia Critic episode where
they read out
Team 4-Star? 50 Shades of Grey.
Yeah. That was fun. Like, I mean, I don't know which voice actor was which, but I thought they did a great job.
But Uncle Yo and the other guy who I can't Brunel remember. Falls. But yeah. But of course, also with me, remember there are numerous ways you can reach the show. You can email at absolution132@yahoo.com. You can also leave a comment on our Facebook page by joining our Facebook page at Absolution Network by searching that on Facebook and liking us, and you can leave a message there. And of course, you can always leave a comment on the site, which you can find at www.an.132productions.com. Also, remember to check out all the other 132 production sites that I do and our friends do. You know, of course, Chris does Random Redbox Reviews, and there's Flashpoint. There's also now Gene now has a new one called Mean Gene, which he's brought into podcast form. And of course, my shows, Tokyo SOS, a Godzilla podcast, where I review every Godzilla movie ever made. You can find that at www.tokyosos.132productions.com. And of course, the Comic Book Crazy podcast, which features my Comic Book Crazy podcast, the comic book pitch, which just had a new episode, which I don't know if Don's checked out.
It's on my queue.
It's, yeah. And of course, Don's favorite, Hexcast.
That is my favorite. because I get mentioned quite often.
Of course, you can find all this at www.comicbookcrazy.132productions.com. And of course, while you're at any of the sites, remember to check out all our friends, not just Don here. Of course, the Dragon Ball Z link is there, but all our other friends, which includes Michael Bailey's Views from the Long Box and From Crisis to Crisis that he does with his good friend Jeffrey Taylor. Brad Douglas' Spider-Man Crawl Space, which also features Don. Because you are on that now.
Yeah.
Yep. Steven Schleicher's Major Spoilers Podcast. And, of course, Scott Gardner's Two True Freaks. Along with many others on the sidebar of the site that you can check out. So that is it for this episode of Tom Sprague. Next week, it's sort of going to be a transitional week, because we finished with Toonami Month, and August will be Ecchi Month, because Don here suggested it.
No, I didn't.
Yes, you did.
No, I didn't, but I encouraged the idea.
You encouraged the idea, therefore you suggested it.
Look, find out what suggestion means.
I'm joking with
where,
you.
Where can you find, what titles are you going to review for this?
I know I'm going to do Ikitosen. I know I'm going to do Princess Lover. I know I'm going to do Golden Boy. I'm trying to figure out if I should do... Should I do an American or another Japanese? Because if I do American series, my American Etsy series will be Stripperella.
Oh, yeah.
But next week is a transitional period between the 2 months, so I thought it actually be funny for me to cover a show... And I'm kind of actually deciding this right now on the spot. A show that I think would be good on Toonami, and that is Birdie the Great Decoy, which is an anime series that came out in 2010. It's a sci-fi series. It's, to some extent, can be a little bit considered kind of a bit, well, not Outlaw Star-like, but almost... It's not Outlaw Star or Cowboy Bebop-like, but it definitely has this sci-fi vibe to it, mm-hmm. that I think people can enjoy. So that will be next week, folks. So until next time, my Toonami generation, stay gold.
A cursed samurai. You have succeeded again in eluding my effort, but I am not worried. For one day,
DJ Clark Nova. Don't sleep on it.